Best fishing of my life this weekend, which, you know, isn't saying much because up until recently, I haven't done a whole lot of fishing. But I got out there this weekend. I've decided to take up the hobby to get, serious is probably too serious of a word, but to get more serious than I have been in the past. For Father's Day, the missus got me my own rod, my own tackle, took it out there. Had a father-in-law who's a big outdoorsman. He's showing me the ropes. And it all came together Saturday night. We were just having a good old time out there on the lake. And it's a lot of fun. You know, we have the really nice clear lake at the cabin that the in-laws have. And so you get your bait within 10 feet of the boat, and you can see what's going on down there. You can see the fish swimming around chasing your bait, and you can see when they take it before you feel it. And it's just a totally different experience actually being able to watch it as it's happening and yank them up one right after the other. It was a good time. My five-year-old, my kids, I got 9 and 5-year-old boys. The five-year-old was having no patience with it whatsoever. He expected, because, you know, kid of the iPad generation, kid of the video game generation, he expects results with every cast. And, you know, 2-3 casts with no fish immediately popping up and thanking him for the meal. And he was having none of it. He's like, this is dumb. I'm leaving. hopefully that'll mellow out as the years progress, as he gets past 5, but it's nonetheless enjoyable to try. Now, I start off the show tonight with a nice family fishing anecdote because it's relevant. It's relevant to the spirit of what I want to discuss with you this evening on Closing Argument. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. My name is Walter Hudson. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. We are live and local this evening. You may be wondering, this is a holiday week. The schedule's going to be a little different than usual. We're here live tonight. We're going to be live tomorrow. We're going to take the 4th off. We're going to come back on Thursday and Friday. And so, you know, 4 out of 5 days on a holiday week, not bad for you. So that'll be a good time. Brad's going to be here less, but we will prevail. We will persist is the word I'm looking for. With, I believe, Breanne's going to come in and help us out.
Just tomorrow night. I'm not leaving. I'm not being shipped away by the Army. I'm just going to enjoy the Greta Van Fleet concert at the Armory tomorrow night.
As well you should. As well you should. So you'll have plenty of opportunities to join us. 651-989-5855 is the number to do so. Brad Omlin taking those calls and producing the show. I want to start off tonight. You know, the reason why I started with something nice and happy and, you know, relatable family fishing story is because I feel like that's where we really need to root ourselves. You know, we got a story we're going to get to here tonight about the stress that people are under as a result of being bombarded with so much news, how it's literally destroying people's lives, how they're becoming unhealthy with the amount of anxiety and apprehension that they experience as a result of being exposed constantly to all the things that are going on and all the opinions and the yelling and the screaming, the hostility. Don't worry. We're going to get into some of that yelling and screaming and hostility here right quick on the show. But I want us to come back to, I want us to return once we go through the crucible of emotion in response to how crazy the left is. I want us to be able to come back to our root, our foundation, which is and probably ought to be happiness. Happiness. The question guiding our conversation this evening is, what condition is required for human happiness? What condition is required for societal peace, for prosperity, for enjoyment, for comfort, for prosperity? What's required for that? And then, you know, once you realize what it takes, once you reflect upon using your own life experience, the circumstances that are necessary in order to manifest happiness and manifest prosperity and peace and, you know, social, relational growth and profit. When you realize that, then the question becomes, which political party, which political personages, which ideas being floated out there in the culture, being floated as rationales for public policy, are actually pushing us in that direction? There is a gentleman who has a social media campaign going with the hashtag is Walk Away. His name is Brandon Straka. He's a gay man, and he is a self-professed former liberal. And he started this movement, hashtag Walk Away. And I want to play this for you, this first segment, and it's going to be the basis from which we continue with the rest of our conversation this evening.
I staunchly reject racism of any kind. I reject the marginalization of any human being based off of their gender or sexual orientation. I reject tyrannical groupthink. I reject a system which allows an ambitious, misinformed, and dogmatic mob to suppress free speech, create false narratives, and apathetically steamroll over the truth. I reject the acceptance of junk science and superstition to advance ideological agendas. I reject hate. These are the reasons why I became a liberal. And these are the same reasons why I am now walking away. For years now, I have watched as the left has devolved into intolerant, inflexible, illogical, hateful, misguided, ill-informed, un-American, hypocritical, menacing, callous, ignorant, narrow-minded, and at times, blatantly fascistic behavior and rhetoric. Liberalism has been co-opted and absorbed by the very characteristics it claims to fight against. For years now, I've watched as people on the left have become anesthetized to their own prejudices and bigotry, and the prejudices and bigotry of those around them who echo their values. I have watched as formerly sensible people who claim to reject racism have come to embrace the principles of universally hating and blaming all of society's problems on all people who have white skin. I have witnessed the irony of advocacy for gender equality morph into blatant hatred and intolerance of men and masculinity. I have seen the once earnest fight for equality for the LGBT community mutate into an illogical demonization of heteronormativity and the push to vilify and attack our conventional concepts of gender. These same self-proclaimed victims of intolerance, now turning on the gay community that they attached themselves to advance their agenda, now calling gay people privileged and themselves victims of injustice. I have watched as the left has allowed themselves to become hypnotized by false narratives and conclusions perpetuated by social justice warriors who misrepresent and misconstrue facts, evidence, and events to confirm their own biases that everyone who does not comply with their prejudicial conclusions and follow their orders is a racist, a bigot, a Nazi, a white supremacist, homophobic, Islamophobic, xenophobic, misogynistic, and alt-right extremist. And I have watched as they have used these heartless and carelessly assigned labels to intimidate, threaten, bully, silence, attack, unemploy, blacklist, and destroy anybody who dares to fight back. They'll come for me, and then they'll come for you. And worst of all, the Democratic Party and the liberal media has embraced, affirmed, aided, and abetted this cult ideology. In an effort to gain voters and maintain power, the Democratic Party that I once loved has joined forces with the extremist left. The Democratic Party and the liberal media now believe their own ill-gotten conclusions and have ominously decided that they, and only they, know the remedy for society's ills. The left has decided that the solution to problems with race relations in America is more racism. The left believes that attacking, insulting, and dehumanizing one group of people elevates another. The left now believes that there are no boundaries when telling lies, omitting the truth, or misrepresenting facts when telling the news, because their end justifies their means. The left has now decided that its point of view is the only acceptable one, and that suppressing, censoring, and banning open dialogue and debate is virtuous and progressive. The Democratic Party has adopted a deleterious belief system, happily and without skepticism, separating people into groups based off of identity, and then organizing them into camps of victims, and oppressors. If you are a person of color, an LGBT person, a woman, or an American immigrant, the Democratic Party wants you to know that you are a victim and destined to stay that way. They will insist that you are a victim, doomed to exist within a system that is rigged against you. That you are a victim of systemic oppression. That you are a victim of your circumstances. And that no amount of hard work or motivational action will ever allow you to overcome your victimhood or the privilege of those around you. This is perhaps the Democratic Party's greatest and most insidious lie. But if you are a minority in America today, the left-wing politicians and the liberal media don't want you to ever discover this lie. So they bombard us with stories designed to reinforce the narrative that you are in danger, that you cannot succeed. They manipulate your fears and concerns by telling you that you're disadvantaged, disempowered, and disposable to everyone except them. They will tell you that you need them. They will tell you that you are only safe under their supervision. They will promise to liberate you from all that chains you. And then they will do absolutely nothing for you. Once upon a time, I was a liberal. But liberalism has changed, and I will no longer be a part of an ideology or political party that represents everything that contradicts my values of unity, equal opportunity, personal empowerment, compassion, and love. So I am walking away, and I encourage all of you to do the same. Walk away.
That man's name is Brandon Straka, and that is a video that he put up on YouTube, Facebook, other social media a couple of months ago, I believe, May 26th, according to this article here at Breitbart.com, and it has been the catalyst for a movement that you can track on Twitter with the hashtag walk away. And just so happened, I checked out his news feed before coming on the show tonight. I guess he was on Tucker Carlson tonight to talk about this. And it's something that is catching on at Breitbart. The walk away movement that began with a popular Facebook video featuring a gay hairdresser in New York City explaining why he was leaving the Democratic Party has quickly morphed into a major force on social media and beyond. According to an article last Thursday in the Epoch Times, some 5 million people on Facebook and YouTube have seen the groundbreaking video showing a very handsome gay man who describes his awakening to the inanities of liberalism and the Democratic Party. And then it goes on to cite the things you just heard that he says in his video. Straka published his original walkaway video on May 26th, and since then, his life has been overtaken by a tidal wave, the Epoch Times reports. The movement has been especially successful because its spokespersons have not been the sort typically associated with conservatism. Young and old, black and white, men and women, gay and straight. The campaign seems to elude stereotypes and pigeonholing. The popular young conservative commentator C.J. Pearson, for instance, a black man, has given the movement a significant push by highlighting the Democratic Party's racist past. He talks about how the Democratic Party is the party of slavery, the party of Jim Crow, the party of segregation, the party of the KKK. Democrats walked away from black folks long ago. Now it's our time to hashtag walk away, he added in a tweet. And so, you know, this is something that, for me, as a black conservative, a black Republican, who's been that way for as long as I've been politically aware, this is a tremendous validation to see this catalyzing, to see this moment of kind of cohesion coming together where on a large and noticeable scale. And look, I'll say this, and then we got to go to break, and we'll talk about it more when we get on the other side. And there's all kinds of things that flow out of this for us to discuss this evening. I do not believe that this is a recent development. I know for a fact that it's not, because, you know, I am a living example, right? There have been and have always been minorities, unconventional voices that are conservative and that believe in the founding principles of this country and that believe in classical liberalism, real liberalism, which is merely the idea that you ought to be free as an individual and that the purpose of government is to ensure that. There have been people who fit that category for a long time throughout society, but their voices have been suppressed. Their voices have been excluded because they don't fit the mold, because they don't prop up the narrative that's desired, not just by the Democratic Party and the hardcore leftists, but by the media itself and by the institutions and establishments which profit and benefit off of this perpetual victimization that Brandon Straka speaks of in his video. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. What I find most noteworthy about that message from Brandon Straka in a YouTube video posted back in May that's prompted a movement, which you can track on Twitter with the hashtag walk away. The idea being walk away from liberalism, walk away from the Democratic Party, walk away from the left. What's integral and foundational to what it is that Brandon Straka is trying to say is he's focused on the concept of happiness and self-worth. That's really what his video is about. It's about the necessity of happiness and self-worth, and really the dignity of that, the confidence that that brings, the prosperity that that enables. And what he's highlighting is that as a former liberal, as somebody who had been aligned politically with the Democratic Party, he got to a breaking point where he realized he could not have that and continue to identify with the left. He could not be happy in and of himself. He could not be proud of himself, believe in himself, and pursue his happiness as he defines it without running afoul of the myriad social expectations and dogmatic rules imposed by his leftist brethren. And this is obviously true, right? Like, it's not just the conservatives that the left is going after. They're going after their own. They're eating their own. And he talks about that. As a gay man, he talks about how just being gay isn't enough to protect you from the rhetorical flames of the new left. You know, because he's white, he's a male, right? So he still has all this privilege. And what you can't see in us playing the audio, you know, go watch the video. You can find it on his channel is The Unsilent Minority. The Unsilent Minority on YouTube is where you can find this. And we'll tweet it out. But as you watch the video, he's got all these articles, all these hot takes that have been posted at a variety of different publications. And, you know, saying things like a gay man's privilege is something, you know, that has to be explored now, right? Like, and we've seen this in the past with different examples of what's called intersectionality. Your minority cred on the left depends upon how many minority oppressed statuses intersect in your life, what you can claim as intersectional statuses. So it's not enough just to be gay. You also have to be, you know, gay, Muslim, black, you know, I don't know what transgender, like you have to somehow be all of it. If you could somehow be all of it, then you're going to ascend to some sort of actualization of progressive divinity. And every mouth that falls from your, or every word that falls from your mouth will be taken as moral gospel that must be accepted without question by virtue of just how much of a minority you are. And when that's the paradigm that your movement is operating from, that is an inherently exclusionary. This is the great irony of it, right? Like, they preach tolerance and inclusion verbally, like they use those words, but the use of those words is the only thing tolerant or inclusive about their movement. In actuality, they are incredibly intolerant. They are necessarily intolerant, like as it emerges as a direct result of their nature, this intolerance and exclusive. They're finding ways to get rid of people. They're finding ways to push people away. And this hashtag walk away campaign is just demonstrative of that. You can only, and look, so is the election of Donald Trump, right? In 2016, and the ongoing success that Trump is having with his brand, with his ability to impact the culture and ride the media beast to his own ends. The reason he's able to do that is because he's capitalizing on the revolt. It's funny because, you know, the left talks about how they're engaged in this resistance. The fact of the matter is they're the objects of resistance. In other words, it's the rest of us who are resisting them. And for a lot of us, that meant voting for Donald Trump. But regardless of where you land on Trump, even if you happen to be, you know, a guy like this Brandon Straka, who used to vote leftist, used to vote for Democrats, is a gay man, he has now joined the resistance against the left, the resistance against this zeitgeist that believes that if you have any sort of pride or confidence in yourself, there is something inherently wrong with you, and you are part of the problem. The only way you can find, I mean, think about this. Just pause and really think about it. Think about how insidious this is. The person, the hypothetical person who is most acceptable to the modern left in the United States of America is the perfect victim. And by that, I mean every aspect of their life is defined by what somebody else has done to them. Not what they've done for themselves, not who they innately are, not what they bring to the table, not what they're capable of, but what has been done to them. And their claim to moral authority is based solely upon being a victim, not achieving something, not having something to be proud of, and certainly not being happy. Like, happiness is not even on the agenda. It's nowhere on the agenda at all. You never get to be happy. Because the person who's happy, the person who's fulfilled, the person who's confident and proud has no place. What are you going to do with that person as a leftist? What are you going to promise them? You have nothing to offer them. You don't have anything to offer the person who's achieved, who's succeeded, who's proud, who's happy. The left has nothing to offer that person. And so the choice that's laid out before us as a culture is, are we going to be happy or not? I'm not even joking. That's the choice. Are we going to be happy or not? Because there's one whole side of the political spectrum in this country right now that has excluded the concept of happiness. You don't get to be happy and be a leftist. And these folks who are part of the Walk Away campaign understand that. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So I actually tripped upon this hashtag walk away movement started by this Brandon Straka very late in my prep tonight. I already had a bunch of stories here then. We're about to dive into them. That I had themed around the concept of Democrats imploding, Democrats unraveling and being unhinged. And that's definitely the case. And it's fortunate to have tripped upon this Brandon Straka guy and his walk away movement as I was prepping for that, because that's the quintessential, that's the manifestation of it. The fact that people are actually declaring that they've had enough and that they're walking away from the Democratic Party, they're walking away from the left, they're walking away from what masquerades as liberalism today, which really has nothing in common whatsoever with liberalism in the classical sense. It's, in fact, 180 degrees the opposite of classical liberalism. And you can find this guy on Twitter, the Unsilent Minority. Search for him there. Also on YouTube, Facebook, worth following. I guess he was on Tucker Carlson tonight. making the rounds. Max Reimer is going to be guest hosting the morning show tomorrow. They're going to be talking about this movement. So this is something that's going to be, we're going to be coming back to on a fairly regular basis. Now, the Democrats have more than just a problem with minorities walking away from them when it comes to the overall movement. They also have electoral problems, particularly in this state, the state of Minnesota, which has historically been such a bastion for the Democrats. You know, recall that in 1984, Ronald Reagan's reelection for his second term, Minnesota was the only blue state on the map. The only one. We've been diehard DFL, diehard Democrats in this state for a very long time. 2016 saw an indication of a change under Donald Trump and what he's doing. There's a map that was tweeted out by Javier Murillo, who you may recall is a friend of the show, SEIU guy, Democrat, muckety muck. He's on the Wrong About Everything podcast, which is produced right here in this studio. And he tweeted out two maps, one from 2012 and the other from 2016, which show the county-by-county breakdown, red and blue, within the state of Minnesota. Between 2012 and 2016, a mere 4 years, the concentration of blue increased significantly. In other words, the blue dots on the map became fewer and tighter around the urban areas, around the big cities. The rural-urban divide is real, and it's significant. From BuzzFeed, in the backyard of a bar in Coleraine, Minnesota, Pat Madure, a former county sheriff, was making his case for the Democratic Party's future in rural America. Universal health care, rural broadband internet, bringing back businesses to an increasingly deserted Main Street. There's some things going on in the Democratic Party that divide us, Madure, who is running for a state legislature seat against a Republican incumbent, acknowledged to a crowd assembled over pulled pork, baked beans, and lemon squares sponsored by the Itasca County Democratic Party. There's a lot of friction in the party. We can worry about that when we get there, but we believe in the same things. To most people in the crowd, it was immediately clear what Madure was talking about. Mining. Here, in and around the state's long-struggling iron mining region, known as the Iron Range, the tension in the Democratic Party between mining advocates and environmentalists is almost palpable. The issue mostly pits people in northern Minnesota's small towns against city environmentalists, and it's a sign of a broader problem. In Minnesota, tension between urban and rural Democrats has been growing increasingly sharp. Democrats on the Iron Range worry it could cost the party in 2018. While Republicans shower rural Minnesota with energy and money, much of Democrats' focus is on the suburbs of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the cities as they're known up here. In the cities, Democrats have the chance to flip two seats held by Republicans in districts that Hillary Clinton either won by 9 points or lost only narrowly. It's the same thing the party is chasing across the country, the chance to win in wealthy white suburbs in places like New Jersey and Orange County, where Democrats are energized and some historically Republican voters, especially white women, are turned off by Trump. Meanwhile, Itasca County is teetering on the edge of losing its long Democratic heritage. It went to Trump in the 2016 election by 15 points, the first time since 1928 that the county had voted for a Republican president. 15 points. That's a hell of a swing. And I don't think there's, you know, we started off the show tonight with a little family anecdote. I told you about my fishing over the weekend, hanging out with my family, my father-in-law, my boys. And the you know, I said that I want us to come back to that, not specifically that story, but that sense of normalcy and happiness and well-being and just enjoying life. That's what people care about. Isn't it? Isn't that what you live for? You know, when you contemplate being on your deathbed, which is a place that we're all going to get to at some point, you know, hopefully we'll see it coming. Hopefully it won't be a surprise, right? We'll actually have a deathbed and we'll have some time to sit there and contemplate. When you're sitting there, there are certain things that you do in your life because you have to do them. But there are other things that you do, all those other things that you have to do in order to ultimately be able to do. You know, put another way, put a simpler way, more articulate way. We work to live, right? We don't live to work. We work to live. Now, what does that mean? It means that we go out there and we be productive in order to provide the material sustenance and abundance and capacity to be able to enjoy our lives. That's ultimately what it's about, is enjoying it, enjoying the relationships, enjoying the fruits of our labor, taking pride in what we've accomplished. And this is something that everybody does, no matter how they vote. No matter how they vote, everybody does that to one extent or another.
I think that BuzzFeed's analysis of the issue is especially poignant because BuzzFeed lives on the left side of the political spectrum. So when they're saying it, you know that it's relevant. And I don't read BuzzFeed news that often, but when they talk about issues within the Democratic Party, I tend to listen because they that's where they live.
They're self-aware.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had my own walk away moment too when I graduated college. I have a degree in political science and journalism. I double majored, and I had two internship offers in DC that I was ready to take after I graduated. But then I still had my job at the radio station, and I knew that I could probably turn it, this was in South Dakota. I had a job at a radio station that I could probably turn into a full-time gig. And I mean, I knew either way I would be broke, working long hours,
right,
and kind of going by the seat of my pants.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that not having to move halfway across the country into the belly of the beast to hustle in D.C. for maybe a few months and then not get another job,
right,
or go to another organization where I hadn't made any progress in terms of income or career standing.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't worth it. And so I took the job in radio, and I wonder what my life would have been like had I moved to DC, you know, what would have that window looked like. But at the same time, like, I don't feel like I made the wrong decision. I just pursued what I thought made me happy, and it has, and it's been fruitful for me.
And this is the reason I'm focused on this, is because this is a key point, a foundational point for how to approach the task of winning first the culture and then the political battles. Because right now, you know, a lot of the political battles are being won just by virtue of how horrible the left is. But in order to have long-term success going forward, there needs to be a strategy to capitalize on what this moment in politics is showing us about the culture. And I believe what it's showing us is something that's actually really obvious, which is that people are motivated by their own happiness. And they're motivated by their own sense of pride, their own sense of security, their own desire to become and to be and to enjoy.
That was the entire basis of an organization that I was involved in college called Students for Liberty. They're still active today and exist a little stronger in Minnesota than when I was around. But that was their entire philosophy is, we are a 501c3. We do advocate for political positions, but ultimately we want to win the culture war. We want to prove that libertarians and people who care about issues are just average people too. And that the only way that we can truly win the culture war is to have people outside of politics as well.
And this divide between rural and urban Democrats here in the state of Minnesota is indicative of that. What you have is people who are on the Iron Range, up north, outstate, whose ability to pursue their happiness is at stake. They've been antagonized and vilified by people within their own party who live in the city, who don't drink that water that they're so concerned about getting contaminated, right? People who don't live up there are telling them how to live and telling them, you don't get to pursue your happiness. You don't get to make a living. You don't get to live your life according to your own rules, led by your own judgment to affect your own ends. And they're turned off by it. That is an opportunity. That is an opportunity to make the case for freedom, for liberty and to push people to the realization, just like Brandon Straka, the gay man who put out this video about why he walked away from the Democratic Party. It's an opportunity to get people to that point, to the walk away point, where they realize, you know what? I don't want to be told what to do. I don't want to be held back. I don't want to be shamed on account of who and what I am and what I believe and what I care about. How dare you, leftist? How dare you, Democratic Party? Act as though I ought to be ashamed, as if I have something to apologize for on account of who I am and what I believe and the values I hold dear. Who the hell are you? That's the attitude that people need to get to, and it should be very easy to guide them there, because this strategy has the virtue of being rooted in reality, in the reality of people's personal experience. They're being shamed by their own every single day. All we have to do is push them to the point where they realize they're sick and tired of it. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. There is definitely something to this thing, this walkaway thing. It's a hashtag on Twitter that's taken off. It's folks who have decided that they're walking away from the left, walking away from liberalism, from the Democratic Party, and the denial and vitriol on social media and in the mainstream media. There's a piece here at the Washington Post. The walkaway meme is what happens when everything, wait for it to load here, when everything is viral and nothing matters. So their response is just nihilism and denial, that it's not really happening and it's not something you should actually believe is taking place. You know, there's other folks claiming that it's a bunch of bots who are crafting these really articulate posts as to why they disagree with what's going on the left right now. Yeah. Uh-huh. Gotcha. What, you know what? More power to you, leftists. That is precisely how we should respond. With condescending dismissal. With exactly the exact methodology that got you to this point in the first place, which is rejecting and excluding and ridiculing and mocking and condescending and blaming and shaming. I mean, what a bunch of bullies. That's all they are over there on the left side. It's just unmitigated, unhinged, uncontrolled, unleashed bullies. Yelling, screaming, calling people names, losing their minds. Talking about, you know, that ad that's been put out by the Republican National Committee recently, Unhinged, where they piece together all the different examples of, you know, Johnny Depp talking about the last time an actor assassinated a president, Snoop Dogg pretending to shoot Donald Trump in a music video. Can't even remember the name of the gal. Kathy Griffin holding the mock severed head of Donald Trump. Madonna talking about how she wants to blow up the White House. That's indicative of where the resistance is at. That's where they're at. Is this place of violence and vitriol and hatred and anger and all the things that they project on the right, all the things that they say the right is all about. That's what they actually are.
Where the left is at right now reminds me of like the language used during the French Revolution.
Yes. Not even a joke. Not even a joke. And if they could get away with it, I assure you, if they could get away with it, they would be pulling people out of their houses into the street and executing them. They would do that. You've got people out there saying it, tweeting it, putting it on their Facebook. I mean, that is what comes next, right? Like the rhetoric, the way that's been ratcheted up. Ben Shapiro, I was listening to his podcast on the way in the studio here tonight. And he's talking about this New York Times piece. I didn't have time to look it up. Apparently, there's this New York Times piece that was written recently. Not even an op-ed. Not even an editorial. It's presented as news. And the premise of the piece is, we need to do something about the First Amendment. We need... The First Amendment has been weaponized by the right and needs to be put in check. That's the premise of this New York Times article. If you follow the premises upon which that type of reasoning is based to its conclusion, you start killing people. Literally. Like, this is not a joke. If you take the premise upon which the case against free speech is based and you follow it through to its logical conclusion, eventually you get to the part where the guillotines come out, where the firing squads are lined up. I mean, this is not speculation. Look to every nation that has gone down this path. Look to the socialists. Look to the communists. Look to Mao. Look to Castro. Look to Venezuela. We've seen the results. Look to the USSR. We know the direction this goes. And when that's the choice, the way I presented it earlier was, we got to decide whether or not we're going to be happy or not. And that's not even simplistic. That is the literal binary choice. Are we going to be happy or not? Because the circumstances under which we can be happy, it's not guaranteed, but the circumstance under which you can be is liberty, and exclusively liberty. You could only achieve happiness when you're free to act in pursuit of it, right? Like, happiness isn't something that is dispensed from an agency. It isn't something that somebody can give to you or bequeath you. Your parents can't leave it for you in their will.
I thought the government could give us that.
The government can't dispense it from a local government building, right? Like, it's something you have to go after. You have to get up and get after. And the only way you can do that is if you're free to do so. This is really simple. Not simplistic, but simple. We need to be free. It's our oxygen. It's our fuel. It's what enables us to go forth and conquer the world that we live in and turn it around to our use in order to achieve our happiness, which is our right as human beings. 651-989-5855. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. We talked last week about the shakeup in New York's 7th Congressional District, where he was ousted in a primary by a young lady by the name of, I believe it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We talked about that as a potential signal of the overall direction that the Democratic Party is going. Hard leftism, a gal who believes in free college tuition for everyone, a gal who believes in universal health care, Medicare for all. You know, isn't it interesting? You know, they're always changing the terminology, right? Now it's Medicare for all. That must be the focus tested phrase that they've come up with to take the place of universal health care, which is the exact same thing and what they used to call it before. But, you know, we got to make sure the terminology keeps changing. Because, you know, which isn't that a pretty strong indication if you have to keep rebranding your ideas in order to trick people into thinking that they're new? Like, isn't that a pretty good indication that your ideas suck?
Well, it's also a good indication that it's a bad idea because, I mean, I don't have any experience with Medicare. I'm not old, but it's not a great insurance plan. Like, right. Anyone who can rely on anything but does.
That's right. That's a solid, solid point. So at any rate, when we were talking about this gal, Ocasio-Cortez, last week, Brad pointed out instinctively, and as it turns out, presciently, that this victory, this primary victory, is not necessarily an indication of the overall direction that the Democratic Party is going, so much as it is an indication of the nature of this particular congressional district. And we have a piece here, some analysis from Daniel Greenfield at Front Page Mag, which really breaks this down in yeoman fashion that I want to share with you here tonight. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can join the conversation at 651-989-5855. Brett Omlin takes those calls and produces the show. From Daniel Greenfield at Front Page Mag, he writes, after the 2010 census, New York lost two congressional seats. Overpriced, lacking any growth industries except tourism and community organizing, the state just couldn't keep up with the rest of the country. New York had been bleeding congressional seats since the rise of the suburbs. After the massacre of 2010, its congressional delegation was the smallest since 1823, and it'll lose more seats after the next census. But the 2010 massacre also forced Representative Joe Crowley out of the 7th Congressional District and into the 14th. The 7th became a gerrymandered district built like a Frankenstein's monster out of parts of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Queens that had nothing geographically in common except Puerto Rican populations, who will keep voting for Representative Nydia Velasquez, a Democrat, until the city sinks beneath the waves. Crowley, who is paler than birch trees, had no shot at the new 7th, but he settled down comfortably in the 14th, winning 70% of the vote by just showing up without the fuss of a primary challenge. While representing a Hispanic district in Queens, he was allegedly living comfortably in Arlington, Virginia. That was never going to last. New York City's working-class white population is an endangered species. If you're not on welfare or earning well in the six figures, you can't afford to live there. Crowley's district was 46% Hispanic. It had the second highest share of Latino voters in New York. The machine poll was living on borrowed time. It's hard to imagine a more vulnerable politician than Doughy Joe, the echo of a 19th century political establishment of bar stools and crony government jobs, used to winning three-quarters of the vote in safe districts and who had forgotten how to compete in an election, if he ever knew how, facing a Hispanic district. Of course, that's not the story you see in the media. Instead, the media thrills to its own fake news of how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the girl from the Bronx, a socialist candidate and giant slayer, impossibly defeated Representative Crowley. And that's accompanied by analysis of how her victory is proof of the inevitable triumph of socialism.
I think it's funny how the left especially crusades against gerrymandering, but it worked out in their favor in this instance.
Right. That's right. They like it. That's like everything. That was Ben Shapiro's point on his podcast today when he was talking about this New York Times piece that's just explicitly going after the First Amendment and saying we need to rein in free speech because it's been weaponized by the right. You know, Shapiro's point was the left is for things when they work for them and against those same things when they work against them. That is their only standard. It is only about the ends. They don't care about the means. They don't care about principle. And that's absolutely 100% true. Continuing at Front Page Mag, the fake news narrative has nothing to do with the truth about Cortez and the reality of the 14th District in New York. The simple truth is that the Democratic Socialists of America and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put in time and money into a district that the Democrats hadn't bothered to protect because Republicans couldn't win it. The secret to Cortez's victory wasn't socialism. It was her last name. Nor is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a girl from the Bronx. She's a daughter of an architect from a pricey suburb in Westchester County. Her father, a Pratt Institute grad, was a founder of KOR, which stood for Kirschenbaum and Ocasio-Roman Architects. The Ocasio, rather than the Kirschenbaum part of the name, meant that it operated as a certified minority business enterprise, which came with assorted privileges. minority business enterprises are able to cut in line and get all sorts of lucrative government contracts. All it takes is having a minority grandfather, and your company is entitled to drink from a river of government cash flowing only to MBE companies. And if your ancestry is whiter than that of Senator Elizabeth Warren, you can always find a minority partner and then let the good times roll at the expense of the working, taxpaying stiffs. After her father cashed in on affirmative action while living in Westchester County, his daughter cashed in her minority card in a New York City election, even though she has far more in common with the white hipster Bernie Sanders supporters who provided the muscle for her campaign than any of the minorities living in a housing project in Queens or the Bronx. But that's also why the media loves Cortez. She's one of them, a suburban leftist with a bio consisting of studying international relations at Boston U, working on immigration issues for Ted Kennedy, serving as the National Hispanic Institute social entrepreneur in residence, producing a web series, shuttling between trendy leftist protests, and founding what appears to be a defunct social justice publishing house. This isn't the biography of an urban minority politician, but an upscale lefty hipster drifting after college from one activist gig to another, developing the context that put her in the right place at the right time.
Well, yeah, no one but a rich daughter would have the opportunity to do all that. Everyone who is the son or a son or a daughter of a poorer person would be working,
right,
like at McDonald's,
right. And yet she's able to put forth this veneer of somehow being the opposite of all of that. And, you know, there are a couple of points here. One is just the facade of it, the fake news, if you want to use that term, of the Ocasio-Cortez victory in the 14th District in New York last week. But the other point is that there's something to be learned here from Republicans and from the right. And it was spoken to by the newly elected chair of the Minnesota Young Republicans when we had him in here. And that's this notion of, you know, when it talks about her drifting from one activist gig to another and developing context that put her in the right place at the right time, that's called party building. That's called having a pipeline, having candidate development, where you're actually trying to put seeds in the ground that will one day sprout into your future campaigns and your future candidates that you can actually build a party off of. Republicans, at least in this state, at least in Minnesota, Republicans don't have that. And if we somehow manage to flip the state to turn Minnesota red, in spite of that deficiency, that's going to be a huge testament to how horrible the left has become. If they lose to our total lack of a machine. But nonetheless, for long-term success, in order to solidify the advances that have been gained, that type of pipeline needs to be created on the right side of the political spectrum. Let's talk to Tom in Eden Prairie. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I appreciate the conversation tonight. I think you're spot on. I've called in before. Hey, I thought it was interesting. During one of your breaks, the news came on, and there was a report of the leaders of Duluth complaining about the cost, you know, $90-some thousand that they had to spend.
Yeah, I saw that too, or heard that.
So it's happening in real time. I mean, they're choosing to say this is bad, demonize Trump. You know, had that been Obama coming there, there would be nothing but praise and glory.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, they should actually be glad Obama didn't choose to live there. I mean, look at what Chicago is spending to build him a library. Right.
Right. Yeah. No, it's an excellent point, Tom. I appreciate it. I recall there were similar complaints on the right when Obama would come to a town. Like, in particular, I remember he came to Los Angeles at some point, and the cost to the city was something in the millions of dollars in order to shut down freeways and provide police protection and all this. And that, just like with the Trump trip, that also was not reimbursed by the White House. But to Tom's point, they weren't complaining about it then, right? Like, you didn't see the top of the hour news or major newspapers highlighting how much of an expense it was to municipal government to host a visit from the President of the United States when Obama was the one doing it. Let's talk to Mike in Farmington. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for taking my call, Walter.
Yep.
See, I'm not one to tell Brad he does a great job with the bumper music, but maybe you can cue up Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne.
right. He'll take it under advisement.
I'm going to actually talk about a little bit about the hallmark of what used to be about the Democratic Party. I just see this whole thing as just tyranny run amok. And it was interesting tonight. I did get to see a little bit of Tucker's show, and he had on that gentleman. And yeah. I'm going to look into that. Hashtag walk away.
Yeah. Brandon Straka, I believe it's pronounced.
Prior to having that gentleman on, he had Tammy Bruce on, and she talked about a Harris poll that was recently came out, and it was about this idea of disbanding or dismantling ICE.
Right.
And even in the statistics that were provided there, she said that even 6 out of 10 Democrats feel that ICE should still be intact.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah, they're out over their skis on this immigration stuff. Now, listen, as you well know, Mike, because I know you're a regular listener, a regular caller, you know, my position on immigration is if we're going to go left, right, it's probably further left than most people listening to this program. I believe that we ought to have significantly less restrictions on immigration than we do. Even so, the idea, I recognize that position is out of sync with where the vast majority of the constituency is. And the Democrats, whose job, like the people who actually are in charge of putting together these campaigns and running these candidates and running these caucuses, their job is to do things that are politically viable. And they've gone from something that was a winning issue, which was, oh, you know, look at all the kids who are crying because they're being taken away from mommy. You know, that was something that they were winning on, and they've turned it into something that's blowing up in their faces, which is this abolish ICE stuff.
Well, I can't remember who said it, but they were saying historically, you know, 90% of the time, the Democrats would get the black vote. And somebody was commenting, I don't know if it was Matt Schlaff or, but anyways, his point was, that's not doing it for them anymore, and they feel like, well, if they can get in the illegal vote, that's a whole voting block that, you know, will keep them in power. And I go back to what, you know, Kennedy used to say things, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Right.
Now it seems more about keep us in power. The Democratic Party really isn't interested in getting you a good job. They're just so power hungry and power mad, they're not serving the citizenry anymore.
Yeah. You'll get no argument from me. I appreciate the call, Mike. I think the question ought to be, I think Kennedy got it wrong. I think the question ought to be, ask what you could do for yourself if your country got off your back. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. We could just play this and just overlay all the clips, the Nancy Pelosi, the Madonna, the Johnny Depp, Maxine Waters. You know, actually, we should do that. We should put that together. Because, I mean, that could be... I mean, just, you know, as a practical production matter, that could be a whole segment. Just give us a little break here on the program. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. From USA Today, President Donald Trump said Friday he will nominate a new Supreme Court justice on July 9th. That is the Monday after the 4th of July, next Monday, a week from today. And that his list of 5 to 7 finalists includes 2 women. Trump did not identify the finalists for the slot being vacated by retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy and said he would interview 1 or 2 candidates during his weekend stay at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. We have great people, highly trained, brilliant, mostly conservative judges, Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One en route to New Jersey. While Trump said at one point that I've got it narrowed down to about 5, he also said he would probably interview 6 or 7 candidates altogether. I'll be bouncing, or I'll be announcing it to on Monday after the 4th of July, Trump said. Susan Collins, this one from Fortune, says that she can't support a Supreme Court nominee who would overturn abortion law. This is from Bloomberg. President Donald Trump shouldn't pick someone for the Supreme Court who doesn't respect legal precedent, including the settled law legalizing abortion, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine said. A candidate for this important position who would overturn Roe v. Wade would not be acceptable to me because that would indicate an activist agenda that I don't want to see a judge have, Collins said Sunday in an interview on ABC's This Week. Collins said she urged Trump during a meeting last week to broaden the list of possible justices he released during the campaign, and that the White House subsequently told her five more people had been added to it. I got the feeling that he was still deliberating and had not yet reached a decision, and that this was genuine outreach on his part, Collins said. There are people on that list whom I could not support. From Politico. No matter whom President Donald Trump picks for the Supreme Court this time around, the nominee is almost certain to come under withering liberal attack as a grave threat to women's rights. Several conservatives close to the White House, however, say they know just how to blunt that looming assault. Pick a woman for the job. With Roe v. Wade appearing to hang in the balance, the battle to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy will be an order of magnitude more intense than the fight last year over filling the seat left vacant after the death of Justice Anton Scalia. Choosing a female nominee could turn down some of the heat on the abortion issue, give some political cover to female Republicans like Senator Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, and complicate the image in TV ads that are expected to savage the nominee, whoever he or she may be. I think the optics do matter. It's harder to make the case that a woman is against women's rights, said Kurt Levy of the Conservative Committee for Justice. Yeah, that's true. You know, just the blanket optics of it. It is going to be harder to make that case, but not impossible, and they absolutely will. You know, look, part and parcel of this walk away thing, the hashtag walk away that you're seeing on Twitter, this guy, Brandon Straka, who put out this video back in May that's triggered this wave of people departing the left and departing the Democratic Party. Where that's coming from is the shaming of minorities. You know, Brandon Straka is a gay man. It's coming from the shaming of minorities for stepping out of line on politics. And so this is the rule. This is how it works. Being black gets you points with the left, so long as you believe what they believe and advocate for what they advocate. The moment you step out of line, being black gets you nothing. I speak from experience, okay? Same thing with being gay, same thing with being a woman. If Donald Trump nominates a woman, will that help with the optics? Yes. But it's not going to stop. They're not going to be afraid to castigate her, who this hypothetical female nominee for Supreme Court. They're not going to hold back. They're not going to keep their powder dry and be like, oh, we can't pick on her because she's a woman. They're going to go after her guns a-blazing. And the fact that she's a woman is not going to matter. They're going to castigate her as evil, as a traitor to womankind, right? Regardless of, even if she doesn't even have a position on Roe v. Wade, right? Even if she's never said anything that could be remotely construed as a position on Roe v. Wade, they're still going to cast her that way. Because of the politics. And the interesting thing to me is this Roe v. Wade stuff, it's not even, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week. I don't see the disaster for the pro-choice crowd if Roe v. Wade was overturned. Because, you know, you have to believe, in order for it to be the catastrophe for quote-unquote women's rights to murder their children, in order for it to be the catastrophe that it's portrayed, you have to believe that subsequent to the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, every state in the union is going to pass draconian anti-abortion laws. And that's just not realistic. Like, the reason Roe v. Wade became a thing in the first place was because there was already political movement in the direction of being more lenient and being more tolerant of mothers killing their children, right? So, you know, the idea that this is going to be some sort of holocaust of alleged rights against women if this thing goes the wrong way from the left's perspective is a little bit much ado about nothing. Let's talk to Barry in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Well, I have a couple different things to say, but I was supposed to stick with what I said I was going to talk about, I guess. So my whole opinion is that if you want to solve the immigration problem, you start by going away from the drug war on drugs and start making it a mental health issue, which starves the cartel. Mm-hmm. By starving the cartel, then they won't have the power that they do in Mexico.
That's
when
correct.
They don't have the power, then there isn't a crime coming across the southern border, and now we stop worrying about the crime coming across the southern border, and we start dealing with it for the problem it is people looking for a better life, and correct. Then we just pick the best people out of them.
Right. You're onto something that I think has a lot of merit. I appreciate the call, Barry. Yeah, that's... Look, we can pick nits, but that's essentially my position. The root of many of the problems that are currently associated with immigration really has nothing to do with the rules that we set about who gets to cross the border and on what terms. It has a lot more to do with unrelated policy having to do with the welfare state and the war on drugs and you know the effect that those things coupled with immigration laws has had on fostering chaos at the border, anarchy at the border. We've created the circumstances which have cultivated the status quo, a status quo which did not exist in decades past. This was not a persistent problem from the founding of the country. It's something that's been created artificially through public policy. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. You can also catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app. Our channel will pop up there for you. You can join us at 651-989-5855. Brad Ullman takes those calls and produces the show. Speaking of calls, I got to take this one. I am absolutely fascinated by Brad's description of the topic. Let's talk to Ann in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Walter. You know, I was thinking through this whole discussion, which has been just riveting. I always enjoy your program, but it's really, really good tonight. And, you know, one of the things that I don't see on the left is gratitude or appreciation for the blessings of America. It's all about what you don't have and what you're entitled to. And this is what they're telling people coming into this country. And you know, it reminded me, I have a friend who's 95 years old, and she came over from Italy with her family when she was about 5 or 6, big Italian family, and they went through Ellis Island. Her father didn't speak a word of English, and he wasn't real educated, but he could get work. He worked 3 jobs. And she told me that one day 2 women came over to their home from the county, and they had several big baskets of food and things for the family. And she said her father was so offended that anyone would think he wouldn't provide for his family. And she still remembers him pointing at her and saying to these women, "You think that she looked hungry?" And they said, "Oh, no, she doesn't. She looks fine." But they said, "This food is free." And he said somebody had to work for it. Somebody paid for it. And he wouldn't accept it. And she said he wanted nothing more than to become an American. And he did everything to learn English as fast as he could. And he raised this big family, and they have all turned out very well. And it just, you know, when I look at the contrast with what we're doing now, telling people that just come to America, you'll get all this free stuff. And then if they don't get it, they're going to be angry. And, you know, and I do agree with the previous caller who said that they're really looking for a voter pool. Just fast track them to be citizens so that they can vote for all the free stuff, you know, and tell them the Republicans will take it all away from you. And so anyway, those are my thoughts as I'm listening to all this.
I appreciate it, Anne. You've provided a lot of food for thought, and appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
The takeaways that I get from that call are twofold. One, she's absolutely right about gratitude. And, you know, that was the description that Brad put up there, is, you know, she wanted to talk about the left's lack of gratitude. And this is something that we've expounded upon on the program quite a bit before. The contrast between what I call the culture of gratitude and the culture of grievance. Two mindsets which cannot peacefully coexist, which cannot occupy the same cognitive space. You cannot be simultaneously grateful and aggrieved, right? Like, you try it in your own mind, in your own heart, to somehow conjure both the sense of gratitude and the sense of being aggrieved at the same time. It's not possible. Yeah. You know? You're not going to be able to do it. It's like trying to push the same end of two magnets together. It doesn't work. And this really defines, in broad terms, the difference between the left and the right. The left, broadly speaking, maintains this culture of grievance, this culture of oppression. You know, we talked last hour about the walkaway movement, hashtag walkaway on Twitter, and that the hypothetical most accepted ideal person within the left's movement would be somebody who is maximum aggrieved, who's achieved maximum victim status, whose every defining characteristic and aspect about themselves is defined by things that have been done to them by some oppressor, not by the things that they've accomplished, not by the things that they've done, not by who they are and what they can be proud of, but by the torment and the oppression and the pain that they've endured as a victim under somebody else's thumb. That is a grievance. You can't be grateful in that position. And this is essential. And Anne's description of an immigrant family who came here in decades past and was actually offended by a handout, right? Which, in that case, in that anecdote, that story, it's a little strange, isn't it? Your neighbor comes over and offers you a basket of food, a welcome package, right? And you're going to get offended about it and turn it away? Like, in looking back at it with our historian's fallacy, our modern mindset, that seems strange. It almost seems odd. But the underlying motivation there, as described by Anne, was pride. You don't need to give me anything. Does my wife look like she needs food? Do my kids look like they're hungry? I don't want what you're giving me. I take care of my family. I don't need to be on the dole. I don't need your handouts. That was the attitude. That's the attitude that people came here with. Now, here's the modern application. This is where I'm going to challenge you. Because up to this point, this audience is with me, right? Now, here's where the needle on the record scratches. There is an opportunity that Republicans have, an opportunity that conservatives have, to reform our approach to this question of immigration, to put us even more in sync with that attitude of gratitude than we already are. Like, we're already more in sync with it than the left will ever be. There's already this innate advantage that's manifest in the walkaway movement where, in order to be acceptable to the left, like, as Anne was describing, they're hoping to recruit a new infusion of aggrieved parties to become a voter base going forward, right? They're trying to bring people in on the narrative of, you've been oppressed and we're here to help you overcome your oppression, right? Which is a very limiting space. I mean, you know, one of the narratives that you're seeing again and again as you go on Twitter and search for the hashtag walk away is you see a lot of folks from the black community who are basically saying some variation of, I've been a Democrat for years. I've voted Democrat. I've been identified as liberal for as long as I can remember. And during all that time, I've been told about all the wonderful things that are going to happen if I vote for Democrats. And I've done so cycle after cycle, and I've gotten nothing for it. That's not an accident. That is the plan, right? Because what happens, how are they going to campaign next time? How are they going to campaign 2 years from now, 4 years from now, if they've solved your problems, right? Like, if the problem that drove you to vote for them in the first place gets solved, then they got nothing to campaign on because you have nothing to be aggrieved about. And people are waking up to this. And so part of the strategy with immigration is let's bring in a new category of people, convince them that they're aggrieved, and then lock them into this generational trap, this cycle of voting for us with the promise that we're going to give you something and then not doing anything for you, cycle after cycle after cycle. As long as we can keep that hacky sack up in the air a little bit longer, it's worth it to us as Democrats, right? That's their plan. Now, Republicans could capitalize on that, but here's the problem. When we vilify immigrants, when we talk about how they're a threat to the American culture, when we preclude, when we make the decision for them that they're not going to assimilate by declaring before they've even had the opportunity to consider our ideas that they're never going to catch on to them and they're never going to choose them, that they're never going to want to be free, that they're never going to want to produce for themselves, that's not a very attractive sell. That's insulting your customer. That's the way we have to look at these folks. They are our customers. Would-be voters. Would-be neighbors. Would-be relationships and transactions that we can engage in. And the way to get them on our side, or the way to undermine the left's strategy on immigration, is to change the rhetoric. To get away from this whole, they're coming here to kill us and they're coming here to undermine our culture and they're coming here to take away our language and our culture and all this jazz, to they're coming here to pursue what they cannot pursue where they came from. And we're the party for that. Republicans are the party for that. The Republicans are the party for having the liberty to pursue your happiness. Don't go for these guys who just want to trap you in a cycle of dependency, like they tried to trap the black community, like they've tried to trap every minority community, and pigeonhole them into these cookie cutter narratives of what you have to be in order to be a good black voter or a good gay voter or a good whatever, right? Don't let them define you, define yourself. That's an easy sell. But the only way we're going to be able to get to that point is if we first let go of this vilifying rhetoric, this demonizing rhetoric. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right, let's close out the show with one of my favorite topics, tariffs. Look, it's become tough for me to talk about tariffs because I'm so frustrated. It's so frustrating to have to explain something that to me really shouldn't require explanation at all.
We're going to get a lot of callers and then we're going to have to go. Like, we're not going to have time for them.
It just, you know, it... The reason why it's so perplexing to me, this issue of tariffs, is that conservatives clearly understand the relevant principles that apply. Clearly, because they've articulated them in other areas. When we talk about healthcare, when we talk about Obamacare, when we talk about taxation, when we talk about government spending, when we talk about any kind of economic intervention by the state into the private lives, private affairs, private relationships of American citizens, conservatives instinctively and correctly understand that that is always destructive. There's no such thing as a taxation that results in prosperity. Nobody ever got wealthy from being taxed, right? Nobody ever was better off because their money was taken from them by the state. Like, that doesn't happen. And conservatives, of all people, properly ought to understand that and do, except for whatever reason, mystically, magically, when the topic becomes tariffs. Then all of a sudden, through some sort of alchemy that I don't understand, and maybe the deficiency is mine. Maybe there's some economic revelation that I have yet to become privy to. Perhaps I'll be traveling down the road towards Damascus one day, and a light will shine from heaven, and I will cover my eyes and fall to the ground and collapse and hear the voice of Trump echo from on high saying, Walter, Walter, tariffs are good. Tariffs shall make America great again. And I suddenly something will snap, something will click, and I'll realize, oh yeah, this is the piece I've been missing. This is how being taxed actually helps me earn more money.
Well, the right does it the same. They have the same hypocrisy with immigration. They would fear the same policies being used against immigrants and people at the border and countries who used against tariffs against us. They would fear the same policies being applied to them.
Yeah, there's this argument that the Constitution doesn't apply to people who aren't from here.
Which is wrong.
There's a sense in which it's right when you're talking about specific privileges that are inherent to citizenship. But when you're talking about fundamental human rights, those pre-exist the Constitution. Right? The fundamental human rights to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the ability to travel, engage a relationship, those aren't granted by the Constitution. And again, to Brad's point, this is something that in any other context, conservatives would be the first ones to shout from the hilltops that the government doesn't give you your rights. They're mine. They're God-given. They're innate in who I am. They're a product of my nature. My rights are mine, and you shall not take them. Unless you're from Guatemala. Then all of a sudden it's, oh, well, you know, you're from Guatemala, so you don't have rights. Right? You're from Mexico, so you don't have rights. Either that or it's some sort of rationalization of, well, it's not our job to recognize your rights because we're Americans. Which, I don't know. That's another thing you'll have to explain to me. From the New York Times, General Motors warned Friday that if President Trump pushed ahead with another wave of tariffs, the move could backfire, leading to less investment, fewer jobs, and lower wages for its employees. The automaker said that the president's threat to impose tariffs on imports of cars and car parts, along with an earlier spate of penalties, could drive vehicle prices up by thousands of dollars. The hardest hit cars, General Motors said in comments submitted to the Commerce Department, are likely to be the ones bought by consumers who can least afford an increase. So the green folks will love this. The environmentalists should be all behind this. There's going to be fewer people driving cars. Demand would suffer and production would slow, all of which could lead to a smaller General Motors. From the, we're not going to have time to get too into it, but we'll start to kind of breeze through it here from the Wall Street Journal. Around the globe, the gears of globalization are shifting into reverse. Companies spent decades farming out every step of production according to where inputs, labor, infrastructure, know-how were optimally located. Now, as trade barriers rise, they are grappling with how to localize production again. You know, globalization is this word that's taken on a very negative connotation, particularly in conservative circles, lefty circles as well. You know, globalism is bad. And look, there's a difference between globalism and globalization. And I think the two words are very commonly conflated with one another. You know, globalism is this idea that we ought to strike down national sovereignty, that we ought to pretend that we're all one big happy human family. That's completely different from globalization, which is the recognition that some places and people are better at doing certain specific things than others. That's called the division of labor, something we should be for. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.